You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the American Postal Workers Union, Local 67, and Blake and Ulig, PC. The American Postal Workers Union, Local 67, serving the greater Kansas City area and providing protection of labor rights for our members on both sides of the state line, as well as our labor brothers and sisters across America. We will continue to fight to stop the closings of processing plants and post offices around the country to protect universal service for all our customers and push back against the corporate forces that would dismantle this scared public institution. And Blake and Ulig, PA, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. Tonight's show, it's New Year's Eve, of course you know that, but it's also one of the biggest cab-hailing nights of the year. So it's a good time to revisit one of the biggest labor stories of 2015, the rise of the so-called sharing economy and the booming startups like Uber with its part-time jobs, meager benefits for its workers. We'll talk to Stephen Hill, author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Then, we do a review of the year's top labor news with Mark Grunberg of Washington Window on Workers. In the news, will Cerner get away with forced arbitration for its workers? And Los Angeles port truck drivers win a victory. Now for the news.
Side, December 24, 2015. The underpaid, exploited port truck drivers at the nation's largest cargo terminal, Los Angeles Long Beach, have won another round in their long fight for fair pay, job protections, and the right to organize, reports PAI. California Labor Commissioner Julie Hsu ruled in December that one of the big port trucking firms, Pacific Nine, misclassified its 38 drivers as independent contractors under labor law. They should be employees. Because they really are employees, Pacific Nine owes them $7 million in back pay, Sue ruled. It also must now pay workers' comp, payroll taxes for Medicare and Social Security, and unemployment insurance for them, all costs it has avoided by misclassifying the truckers. And it must repay the 38 drivers for the past costs they incurred when Pacific Nine forced them to pay for unlawful deductions for like permits, license fee, fuel, road taxes, inspections, parking, registration, truck rental payments, truck insurance, and even port entry fees, Sue's agency ruled. She also ordered Pacific Nine to pay drivers for truck repairs and maintenance. Now they are employees. The drivers have the right to organize also. The Teamsters and its Southern California Joint Council 42 have waged a years-long campaign to win both employee status for the thousands of port truckers and to organize them. The Los Angeles Long Beach port truckers are one of many workers misclassified as independent contractors who have taken to the streets in the last 2 years to demand living wages and workers' rights. Others include Walmart, warehouse, and fast food workers, home health care aides, and, as our show tonight explains, Uber drivers.
Remember the news story a few weeks ago about Cerner requiring employees to sign an arbitration clause if they want to get raises? This story from PAI questions the legality of such a move. When it comes to workers' rights, the National Labor Board, the NLRB, is casting a very jaundiced eye at forced arbitrations. In a long string of recent rulings on the issue, covering enterprises ranging from the giant CVS pharmacy chain down to a pizza parlor in Brooklyn, the board majority is declaring that employers' decisions to force individual workers to sign agreements with binding arbitration also means the workers are signing away their labor law rights, illegally. And especially, the board adds, the forced arbitration clauses take away not just the workers' rights under labor law, but their right to file class action suits as well. Quote, if you have signed an employment contract in the past 15 years, the chances are good that you also signed away your rights to sue your employer if you get fired, or bad reasons, or feel that you have been discriminated against at work, warned a Greenbelt, Maryland labor law firm, Joseph Greenwald and Peek, in a blog on a legal website, FindLaw. Quote, if you sign this agreement, then you agreed not to pursue any legal action against your employer in court. Instead, any disputes that you have with your employer must be settled through a process known as arbitration, the blog added. The board doesn't like such arbitration's exclusions of workers' rights. After all, many arbitration agreements let the employer pick the arbitrator, although sometimes both sides must agree on a, quote, neutral person, and the arbitrator's decision is final. And implicit in the arbitration agreement is that if the worker, especially a prospective hiree, refuses to sign, the worker will lose the job, the board says. That combination of coerciveness and threats to workers' rights raises the NLRB's hackles, or at least the hackles of its three-member majority. GOP named NLRB Philip Misamara has dissented in every case tossing out arbitration clauses. Whether Cerner's arbitration agreement is illegal will probably have to be litigated. That's if someone has the guts to file a case, but the loss of wage increases if a worker doesn't agree to forced arbitration of labor law violations sure sounds like coercion.
Our listeners may recall our coverage a few months ago of the Lac-Mégantic oil train disaster in Quebec and the prosecution of the train's engineer, Tom Harding. The disaster occurred 2.5 years ago when engineer Harding was off the parked train. It broke loose, headed downhill, jumped the tracks, crashed, exploded, burned, and virtually destroyed downtown Lac-Mégantic. The disaster killed 47 and ruined businesses in the downtown. The crash and the explosion brought public prominence to the danger of heavily loaded oil trains passing through cities and towns around North America, and led to anti-oil train protests by Railway Workers United and allied environmental groups. RWU is a coalition of rank-and-file union train workers, including Teamsters and Smart UTU members. On December 22nd, a settlement with actual and economic victims of the explosion, but it still leaves the train's engineer and dispatcher, both steelworkers, facing trial and several high-up managers who were responsible for conditions that led to the crash, have escaped prosecution altogether. Their company, Montreal, Maine, and Atlantic Railway, is out of business, but it will pay $460 million Canadian to families of 41 of the 71 dead and to economic victims of the crash. The families get 1/4 of the total. Owners of the destroyed businesses get the rest. $460 million Canadian equals $330 million in the United States. But engineer Harding still faces 47 counts of criminal endangerment causing death. If convicted, he faces life in prison. Also facing trial set for April on the same counts are dispatcher Richard Labrie and former MMNA Manager of Train Operations, Jean Dumatre. And Harding and Labrie are members of the Steelworkers of Canada. All three have pleaded not guilty. Four other former MMNA employees pleaded not guilty in November to violating Canada's Railway Safety Act and the Fisheries Act. If convicted, they face $50,000 fine, 6 months in jail, or both. Former MMNA President Robert Grindrod is one of the four. Higher-up officials responsible for the policy that left only Harding working the train were admitted. They drew the ire of supporters of the workers and steelworkers Local 1976. Metallo, the Steelworker District 5 magazine, said the Canadian government bears responsibility for the Lac-Megantic disaster by letting freight trains run with only one-person crews and by not enforcing safety laws. Adding insult to injury, the government is trying to lay the blame on two ordinary workers who faced serious criminal charges. Tonight's news was read by Molly Madden, Chino Scalisi, and myself, Chris Mann.
And now we're going to have an interview that we did about a month ago with Stephen Hill, author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. The interviewer is Jake White.
In an essay this morning at the Huffington Post, Peter Dreyer responded to news Harold Meyerson would no longer be writing a column for the Washington Post. Quote, "More than any other columnist for a major U.S. newspaper, Meyerson provided ongoing coverage and incisive analysis of the nation's labor movement and other progressive causes, as well as the changing economy and the increasing aggressiveness of big business in American politics. He was one of the few columnists in the country who knew labor leaders and grassroots activists by name and who could write sympathetically and knowledgeably about working people's experiences in their workplaces and communities. Since Steve Greenhouse retired last year at the New York Times, no other major paper has a reporter who covers unions and working people on a full-time basis. Now, with Meyerson's firing, there's not one weekly columnist who understands the ins and outs of organized and disorganized labor." Unquote. We wish Mr. Meyerson the best, and we at Heartland Labor Forum hope a major U.S. newspaper decides to start covering labor issues again soon. Not long after I completed the following interview with Stephen Hill, In These Times ran an article called When Labor Groups and Silicon Valley Capitalists Join Forces to, quote, disrupt protections for employees. The article was by Jay Youngdahl and Darwin Bongram, and it discussed a letter written by a broad array of stakeholders in the sharing economy, coming from both labor and management. The letter was not signed by Stephen Hill, but it was signed by some of the individuals he profiles in his book, including David Rolfe. The debate over the best way to respond to the sharing economy startups has slowly been heating up for some time now, and 2016 looks to be a big year. According to Youngdahl and Bongram, quote, "The letter's call that on-demand economy workers forego litigation to gain wages and benefits owed to them appears to allude to attorneys like Shannon Liss Reardon. Liss Reardon is helping workers sue Handy and Lyft, two of the companies whose CEO signed the letter. These are good words, obviously," she said about the letter's focus on benefits, but, quote, "I'm concerned seeing labor groups on here. I'm wondering whether they're fully informed as to what they're putting their names on." Liss Reardon said, "Labor activists should be trying first and foremost to ensure that existing laws are enforced and that companies aren't allowed to misclassify workers as freelancers. While the two can certainly be done simultaneously, given rampant misclassification, the emphasis on creating a new portable safety net and put down of wage and hour litigation is at the very least tone deaf to workers who are currently engaged in battle with employers who are avoiding providing benefits through misclassification." Youngdahl and Bongram go on to say, "The letter comes just as the Obama administration has finally taken action against worker misclassification and made it easier for workers formerly classified as independent contractors to join with fellow workers to advance their own interests. In the southern construction industry, for example, workers, especially Hispanic immigrants, have routinely been cheated and taxpayers fleeced by misclassification. And so the litigation of Handy and Lyft, being led by Shannon Liss-Riordan, looks to be, in my opinion, one of the biggest labor stories of the year for 2016. And we hope you'll continue to tune in and stay on top of the latest in labor politics and activism as we cover these important topics. And now, after a brief musical interlude, we'll replay our interview with Stephen Hill about Uber, originally broadcast this November. Right. Hello, this is Jacob White for the Heartland Labor Forum, and today I'm going to be talking to Stephen Hill, so here's a brief introduction. In an article published yesterday about how tech billionaires are trying to Uberize the trucking industry, the journalist Mark Ames wrote, "For all the internet's initial promise of smashing traditional hierarchies and creating horizontal structures that democratize power and politics, the reality is that the internet economy has centralized power and wealth, and the political economy on a scale not really seen since the railroads destroyed the old economy and quickly created hugely centralized new industries, which centralized into trusts and created a class of oligarchs with outsized wealth and power that no democracy could survive." Joining us today is Stephen Hill, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, who has studied and experimented with the so-called sharing economy, and is the author of Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, from St. Martin's Press. He is here to tell us about the negative effects of technological disruption for workers in the United States. Thanks so much for joining us, Stephen.
My pleasure.
So, one of the most surprising and convincing parts of your book is when you explain just how much the ideological underpinnings of Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road mirror those of leaders of Uber and Airbnb and other companies like them. Can you tell us a bit about Ulbricht's story?
Well, Ulbricht was the head of the website called Silk Road, which was a black market website. You could buy all sorts of drugs on there. You could buy guns. You could buy just about anything that was illegal, including, by some reports, you could even hire hitmen on that website. And what was remarkable to me was how, if you took the words of Ross Ulbricht and you put them up against, words coming from other CEOs like Brian Chesky from Airbnb or Travis Kalanick from Uber, and you said, okay, which one of these quotes is coming from which of these CEOs? You couldn't tell one from the other. They all were filled with this notion that somehow what they're doing is revolutionary, that they're pulling together a community of people going up against the government, and the government is evil. And you have to somehow fight back against government, and there was just a lot of parallels there. And Silicon Valley in general is a place where there's kind of a pirate culture there. You know, always trying to get away with beating government and disrupting things and creating chaos. And out of chaos will come good things eventually, but not right now. I mean, there's just so many interesting parallels like that that I explored them in the book a little bit, and it was quite interesting, I thought.
And you term people like this techno-sapiens. Is Ross Ulbricht a techno-sapien?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Silk Road was using the web to connect people. Sometimes a sharing economy is called a peer-to-peer. It connects you to me without any middle person for buying and selling. And Silk Road did that extremely well. If you went on their website, it was just like going on Amazon. You could buy all sorts of things. It just happened to be all those things were illegal. And so it was an interesting example of how, if you take the kind of mentality, the Ayn Rand fundamentalist mentality, libertarian mentality of Silicon Valley, if you take it to its extreme, you end up at a place like Silk Road. And many of these companies today, I mean, they're not as extreme as Silk Road, but they are encouraging lawbreaking. They are encouraging not paying your taxes. You know, Airbnb, it doesn't say to its host, look, you know, if you're renting out your place, you're actually by law supposed to pay a hotel tax for renting out your place. And so you're going to have to do that, and we're going to facilitate that. Airbnb doesn't say that. Instead, they just ignore it, and they're fine with their guests ignoring it. And that means cities who depend on that hotel and occupancy tax for, you know, revenue for local programs, they're losing money because people are staying with Airbnb instead of staying with local hotels. And it works the same way with Uber. You know, taxi companies pay what's called a livery tax for being able to operate a taxi company. Uber doesn't pay it. It doesn't make its drivers pay it. And so all these different companies, as well as the people who are working for these companies, are in a real sense putting one over on the government by not following laws and not paying their taxes.
Ulbricht is also seen as a more extreme version than Airbnb and Uber, but he's also seen as a visionary of the underground economy. You kind of mentioned the whole pirate identity that's been growing in Silicon Valley. So, and more broadly than just Silicon Valley, but what is the underground economy?
Well, the underground economy is, you know, everywhere from the gray economy to the black economy, people working under the table, people getting paid in cash instead of, you know, through their bank accounts, because it can't be tracked by the government. And then, you know, ultimately these sorts of people don't pay taxes on their income, which means government has less money to do good things with it, and, you know, have services for people, for elderly people and for children and these sorts of things. We're living in a time where there's a rather interesting dilemma where our economic measurements aren't really capturing what's going on in the labor force. And I'll give you one example. According to traditional economic theory, when the unemployment rate comes down, the employment rate is supposed to go up. They're inversely related, like a seesaw. When one goes up, the other side goes down. And so that's how it's supposed to work. But in fact, the time we've been living in, the unemployment rate is coming down, but the employment rate is not going up. That means the unemployment rate is coming down because the workers who were unemployed before, they've quit looking for work. They're what's called discouraged workers, and as a result, they don't show up in economic statistics. And so it looks like the unemployment rate is going down, yet the employment rate is not going up. And you know, estimates are that since the Great Recession in 2008-2009. About 12 million U.S. workers are no longer in the labor force. They're just, no one knows what happened to them. No one knows how they're making money. You know, clearly a certain number of them have drifted into the gray economy. Some of them have drifted into the black economy. And some of them are using sharing economy, gig economy companies to make some money here and there. I mean, they're basically piecing things together any way they can to make a living. Almost going back to the time, like in the 19th century, where people did piecework and, you know, didn't have regular jobs that they reported to. They just did a little bit of this, a little bit of that, just, you know, sort of stitching together any kind of way to make a living.
And I wanted to go back to the 18th and 19th centuries. Before the rise of capitalism, there was a guild system where you would have to be an apprentice for a while and then you could join the guild. And from then until about now, we've had the relationship between capital and labor, but mostly on the individual level, the relationship has been between a worker, their union, and a single capitalist firm. One major point of your book is that this relationship is being transformed. So now we're moving towards a freelance society with 1099 workers. Can you tell us what a 1099 worker is?
A 1099 worker refers to a contractor or a freelancer or in some cases a temp worker who is not regularly employed, and they fill out what's called a 1099 form that goes to the IRS. And the 1099 refers to the IRS form that's used for this type of worker, as opposed to a regularly employed worker where they use a W-2 form with the IRS. So what we're seeing is the rise of what I call the 1099 economy. More and more workers are becoming contractors, freelancers, temps, and of course these sorts of workers are treated very differently than regularly employed part-time workers. Those sorts of workers don't have any safety net, so they're not getting any health care from their employer. They're not getting any Social Security or Medicare. They're not even getting injured worker compensation or unemployment compensation. If they get injured on the job, they not only lose their job, but they also have to pay for that injury themselves because there's no injured worker compensation. So these are the sorts of things that that more and more workers are being subjected to. From the labor's from the employer's perspective, the reason why you go to this is because you're saving 30% of your costs by not paying for all the safety net benefits that the workers have. But from the worker's point of view, suddenly you're really out there on your own with very little support. All you have is your wage, and in many cases for these sorts of jobs, the wages aren't very good. And so increasingly employers are using this as a way to cut their costs. And I'll give you an example. The pharmaceutical company Merck, they had a plant in Philadelphia. They sell the plant to another company. The company lays off all 400 workers, then hires back the exact same 400 workers and proceeds to make the same drugs for Merck as before, just with the same workers now as contractors instead of irregularly employed employees. So this is the type of, more and more companies are doing these sorts of tactics in order to get rid of regularly employed workers and to go to these contractors. And it's just a race to the bottom. And it's going to undermine the middle class as this becomes more and more a tactic that's being used by more and more employers.
A lot of UAW union members have been pretty critical of the two-tier system, and you mentioned an even more extreme version of that at a Nissan plant. Is that right, where they have workers working next to temp workers who don't get the same benefits?
Yes, that's right. In the book, there's a story of a worker. His name is Chris Young. He works at a Nissan plant in Tennessee. And, he's working alongside a lot of other workers. Those workers are wearing the Nissan shirt because they work directly for Nissan. But Chris Young does not. He works for a contractor. Even though he's doing the exact same work as all the other workers, he's a contractor. And for that, he gets paid half the wage. He has no safety net, no job security. And life is really hard for him, even though he's doing the exact same work. And he's a temp worker, but there's a new name for temp workers like him. They're called permatemps because oftentimes they're working there at the same position 3, 4, 5, 6 years. You think a temporary worker would just be for a few months, and yet these workers are staying in these positions for years. And at this point, half of the workers in auto plants are temp workers. And since the Great Recession collapse in 2008, 2009, about a fifth of the jobs that have been created in the United States are temporary jobs like this. So this is the fastest growing part of the labor force, and that should be extremely alarming because these are not very good jobs. Workers working these jobs are not treated well.
And not only do we have a rise in temporary jobs, but we also have a rise in people who maybe are renting out a room in their house and then driving a Uber and then also doing sales for, a third of the day or something like that, which you were pretty critical of how the freelancers are approaching that sort of attitude in your book. You want to explain what's wrong with having to work three jobs if that...
Well, I have a story in my book of Maria Fernandez. She was she worked for Dunkin' Donuts, and she was a part-time worker. She worked for three different Dunkin' Donuts franchises because none of the single franchise wanted to give her enough hours at work, because if you go above too many hours, then you have to start giving a safety net to the workers. So instead, each franchise would give her just a part-time work. That way they didn't have to pay her any of the safety net benefits. And so she had to have three of these jobs in order to live. And it just kept her running from one to the other. She was sometimes doing overnight shifts, then morning shifts, then day shifts, having a hard time getting enough time to even sleep. She just drove up and down the New Jersey Turnpike from one Dunkin' Donuts store to another. And she, in order to make sure she didn't run out of gas, she began keeping a gas can in the car with her. And one morning, early morning, about 5:30 in the morning, she pulled into a Wawa convenience store to get a few hours of sleep. They found her later that afternoon. She had died in her car of asphyxiation from the gas fumes. The gas can somehow had gotten knocked over. And so she died from this asphyxiation. She was still in her Dunkin' Donuts uniform when she died. And this created a bit of a national outcry because it made people really wonder, what kind of economy are we creating here? What kind of jobs are we providing for people when someone would have to work three different part-time jobs at the same business? I mean, you know, if Dunkin' Donuts had given her just one job that, you know, that pay for more hours at one of the stores instead of making her go to three different ones, she would have had a safety net, she would have had a better job, she wouldn't have been running up and down the turnpike. But instead, the incentive for the Dunkin' Donuts, which is a very profitable business, the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts makes millions of dollars a year, and yet they couldn't even give her a decent enough job so that she didn't have to work under these types of living conditions. So, you know, this is the reality for more and more workers in this American economy.
You spend some time in the book talking about how activists and organizers are trying to respond to this. You interview David Rolfe, who's a SEIU Seattle, pretty well-known and respected organizer, and your guys' conversations seem to be building towards the idea of a third wave of labor organizing, or labor 3.0.
Okay, and that was Jake White interviewing Stephen Hill about the Uber economy. And we'll come back. I know it cut off right in the middle. We'll come back in a minute after a couple messages.
Hey, it's Junebug, and it's time for the infamous Blues Kitchen Live Show. We will be broadcasting live from BB's Lawnside Barbecue on Saturday, January 23rd from 8 to 11 a.m. Three blues bands, barbecue breakfast, and don't forget the Bloodies. That's Saturday morning, January 23rd, 8 a.m. $10 at the door, with proceeds benefiting your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI. Advance tickets and info at kkfi.org.
The Human Being, in celebration of love, activism, and the arts, a gathering of tribes in support of KKFI, Saturday, January 16th, 7 to 9:30 at the Uptown Arts Bar, featuring Zanzibar drums, period music from Victor Doherty and Paul Coleman, poets from The Writer's Place, Jose Faust and Sharon Eicher, and from Poetic Underground, Doug Nightlife Jones and Nick Gavecci. Host and DJ Misconception. Advance tickets and information at UptownArtsBar.com. Sponsored by Cooper's. It's a beautiful day in the Uptown Arts Bar.
You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and we're going to return to the conclusion of Jake's interview with Stephen Hill about Uber. Then we'll have a musical break with some of Jake's favorite labor tunes, followed by my interview. I'm Judy Ansel. On the news highlights of 2015 with Mark Grunberg of PAI Labor News Service.
What's an example of Labor 3.0 and how it can be effective?
Some examples are the National Domestic Workers Alliance, some of the taxi cab companies, or not companies, but alliances of workers, of taxi cab drivers. And, you know, these aren't unions in the traditional sense, in that they are trying to negotiate a contract with an employer. Instead, what they're doing is they're trying to raise the public awareness of how these workers are treated, and then trying to get laws passed in order to make their working conditions better. So the domestic workers, for example, managed in New York to pass a law that says that if you work above 30 hours for any particular employer, that you get some, you know, some paid vacation time and paid sick leave and these sorts of things. And that's all really good. But the problem is that, you know, once you set a number like that, you say, okay, above 30 hours you get this, below 30 hours you don't get anything, the employer makes sure you only get 29 hours, you know?
Yeah.
That's the real problem with that approach. And so what I've proposed in my book, Raw Deal, is another way of going about this. And what it would do is it would require all businesses, regardless of whether they're hiring contractors or whether they're hiring you know, regularly employed workers, they would still pay a certain amount into a fund, what I call an individual security account for that worker, that would be prorated to the number of hours that that worker works for that business. And they would pay about, you know, it works out to about $2 per hour above the wage, and that money would then be used to purchase the safety net that that worker needs. This is a much better way to go about doing this than, you know, having these sort of cutoffs where above this amount you get a safety net, below it you don't, and all the loopholes that come with that. You know, these are the sorts of, I think, innovations that we need to go. Creating portable benefits for a multi-employer world where you have more and more people who are working for multiple employers.
We only have about 45 seconds left, but I would like to ask you, we've talked about how to lift up the workers in this new economy. What about reining in Uber and Airbnb? What can we do from a regulatory perspective real quickly?
Well, I think you have to make them follow existing laws. I mean, Uber is a taxi company, and you already have laws on the books for taxi companies. Make them follow those laws. Airbnb, they should be paying their taxes and following local laws. I mean, Airbnb has become a loophole for professional real estate operatives to take over the housing stock and instead of renting it out to local residents, renting it out to tourists. That more, if you look at Airbnb's business model, where their revenue is coming from, more and more, that's where Airbnb's revenue is coming, is these professionals. It's not coming from regular people who are just renting out a spare room in their home, and no one has a problem with that. But the professionals are invading this platform and turning it into something that it was never meant to be. Airbnb at this point, unfortunately, has drifted very far from its origins, and local governments need to really crack down on it or it's going to take over your housing stock.
Stephen Hill is the author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, from St. Martin's Press. Please go out and get the book. And Stephen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, long, long, black, long disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
Hi, this is Judy Anson. Tonight, our Washington, D.C.-based labor news guru, Mark Grunberg, who does our monthly feature, Washington Window on Workers, will give us an extended interview and a review of key labor stories from the year 2015. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year in advance to everybody.
And Happy New Year to you. You did an amazing special report last week called The Year in Headlines, Politics and Protest. And you said, for workers and their allies, 2015 began with politics and ended with more politics. But there were a lot of protests and activism in between, including fights with anti-worker forces ranging from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. So, isn't that true every year? What makes 2015 different?
2015 was different in two ways. First of all, the politics got started early in January with a special conference, you'd call it, that the AFL-CIO hosted here in town to unveil its Raise the Wages agenda, a comprehensive agenda to try to lift the wages of workers in the middle class. And then President Richard Trumka was very specific, even that early. Mind you, we're talking about January 6th or so. He said, this is going to be the agenda that we judge politicians on. And not just their words, but their deeds. They got to sign on the dotted line, and they got to show us that they're going, that they're doing what they say they're going to do. That's how it started. That's how it ended, was with space of endorsement, union endorsement of various presidential candidates.
Right. So the 2016 elections started in January of 2015. That's what you're saying, huh?
Right. Right. Exactly. For workers and their allies. Yes. It started early, very early. And here's the in between. In between, what we saw was the rise of the Fight for 15 movement. That the people took to the streets saying, I've had it, I'm fed up, I don't want to work for the slave wages anymore, I want $15 an hour, and the right to organize. And at the end of the year, the two are coming together. The last of the Fight for 15 protests, right around just before Thanksgiving, you had 15, Fight for 15 protests. Well, one of them was in Milwaukee the night of a Republican presidential debate there in Milwaukee, and they made it very clear that they are going, that the Fight for 15 people, and these are the people who are the most exploited, the lowest paid, are going to judge the candidate at all levels by whether they support that cause or not. Here's the politics melding with the protests, if you will.
Okay. Well, let's go back to that Raise the Wage campaign. What are the principles or the measures that the AFL-CIO is advocating that they want to see?
Several. First of all, raise the minimum wage. Second, right to organize. Third, comprehensive immigration reform. Fourth, not just right to organize, but comprehensive labor law reform. Fifth, add the democracy movement in it. In other words, make sure you can vote and you have the right to vote. And finally, just on top of all that, enforcement and free trade. Enforcement and free trade. And when I say free trade, they mean free trade in the real sense of the term, not the TPP, but free trade that's also fair. Later on in the year, women's economic equity also got added to the Raise the Wage campaign.
Okay, so we'll get back to some of these, and that TPP means the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You mentioned that unions were doing endorsements, and wasn't this awfully early? Don't unions usually wait until at least the presidential year, if not after the primaries, in order to do endorsements?
Usually, but that started to shift the last election cycle. In 2008, the last open seat election, if you will, for the White House, the endorsement started in about December. This year, they really jumped back early. The teachers let off in July. American Federation of Teachers endorsed former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in July, and they caught a lot of flack from their rank and file for being so early.
And I think the last endorsement so far this year, I don't think there's going to be any more this year, was communications workers who endorsed Bernie Sanders after polling their members.
Right. Right, and that was an interesting endorsement, speaking as a member of the communications workers and the newspaper guild, because what they did was we did it electronically, and you could go to each of it. They had links to each candidate's website, regardless of whether the candidate was Republican or Democrat. You could see what the candidate had to say for himself or herself, and they posted the AFL-CIO's questionnaire, which is a detailed questionnaire, to each of the candidates, and they posted the questionnaire and the responses. Not all the candidates responded. As a matter of fact, only one of the Republicans, Mike Huckabee, the former Arkansas governor, did. And, of course, all three Democrats did. So did Jim Webb, but he later dropped out. So you could go through, read the detailed specifics, or lack of them, in each candidate's responses, and then make your selection. And so they wound up with a huge outpouring of votes, electronic votes from their members, and an absolute majority, so says CWA, for Bernie Sanders. And that was a big swing in their endorsement.
Well, we're seeing here a lot of grassroots support from union members for Sanders as well. We had one big local here endorse Sanders, IBEW 124. You know, you don't mention Donald Trump at all and the Trump phenomenon. Wasn't that big news, and especially since he doesn't seem to have any pro-worker positions?
It was big news in a negative way, in that, first of all, he, like the rest of the Republican field, is anti-worker, and specifically, the workers at one of his largest hotels in Las Vegas voted to unionize with the Unite Here and challenged Trump to back up his own words, put his money where his mouth is, and negotiate a contract.
Did he do it?
As you can imagine, Trump, the Trump organization is appealing the election to the NLRB. So,
Okay.
Going on.
All right. We're talking to Mark Grunberg in Washington, D.C., and doing a recap of the big stories for labor in 2015. So, Mark, enough politics. Let's talk about what happened of significance on the labor front. You talk about bargaining, strikes, contracts. Were there any really significant ones?
I would say there were two significant ones. One, a battle over contracts, and the other, a movement. The movement we've already talked about. The low-wage workers. These are the restaurant workers, the fast food workers, the retail workers, the Walmart workers, the port truck drivers, the janitors, the home health care aide, you name it. All of these folks who have been downtrodden for years have finally taken to the streets and say, we have had it, we want a decent living wage, we want to be able to raise our families, and we want to be able to organize without employer interference or harassment or intimidation or firing.
Okay, well, let me stop you there, because... Were there any really, aside from the mass mobilization and the addition of new low-wage workers to that struggle, which we've covered extensively on this show, were there any significant gains made in that fight, or are we still at the protest and organizing stage, and or would you say there were any victories?
There were victories in Massachusetts. The governor signed, and this is a Republican governor, mind you, signed a contract with the home health care aides. We're talking about 30,000 home health care aides. They're going to get $15 an hour. And let me see, there's another one New York. Governor Cuomo appointed a commission to look into the state of all the low-wage industries, including the garment workers, or what's left of the garment workers in New York. And that commission has already said the fast food workers in New York, I deserve $15 an hour, and we're talking statewide, not just New York City. Second victory in New York. Starting today, every state worker in New York is guaranteed $15 an hour.
That's great. Yeah. Well, and I also want to mention that we had a big fight here in Kansas City and also in St. Louis to try to raise our city's minimum wage. And we got our city council to pass it. Unfortunately, state legislature then preempted it, and that's an ongoing battle because there's court challenges to that. And I know that, in other cities and states, there have been minimum wage struggles to increase the minimum wage. So that's really a hot issue.
And that goes back to the politics, because what happened in the Missouri legislature has been happening in other legislatures. A city, say it's New York or Chicago or whomever, or Philadelphia or whomever, will raise its minimum wage. And if the Republican controlled state legislature, luckily not in Illinois, it's a Democratic legislature, will try to override that by yanking the powers from the city.
Yeah.
And basically vetoing those ordinances.
Right.
So again, politics rears its head.
Let's go back to bargaining. You talked about the oil workers' bargaining campaign. What's significant about that?
What was significant about that, and it finally broke through, was the oil companies have been in denial for years about their accident record at their refineries. Refineries average, for the last 5 or 6 years, have been averaging an accident a week nationwide, according to records kept by the steelworkers, drawn from public records and newspaper stories and, filings with state. That's not counting the unreported accidents. Not to say all of them are fatal, but enough of them are fatal, and certainly enough of them are dangerous, that it's something that you could say, it's something to pay attention to. Well, this, in the last year's oil round of bargaining, this time the steel workers, who now represent the nation's refinery workers, went to the mat and said, this is our top priority. You have to do something about safety. we have to do a joint meet. You can't ignore the problem anymore. The oil companies refused to bargain. They forced the steel workers out on strike over safety. And, you know, the strikes, the public protests, the eventually at home, we call them the Seven Sisters, the major oil companies came around and bargained, okay, we're going to have joint safety committees. We're going to have consultation. We're going to have joint efforts to clean up the safety mess in all the refineries around the country.
Well, that's not to say
it's going to happen overnight, but this is a big step forward.
Uh-huh. At the state level, there, of course, have been a numerous right-to-work fights over the last few years, but I guess one thing good about 2015 is that no new state passed right-to-work. And, of course, that gets us to Missouri. You want to talk about that?
Here we go again, yes. We had the whole long fight in Missouri this past year over right-to-work, where enough Republicans, and let's give them credit, enough Republicans in the state legislature defected from the party line, stood up to incredible pressure, including threats to find candidates to run against them in the primaries next year, from the party leadership, and voted no on right to work. There weren't enough to vote no on the initial passage back in the early part of the year, but there were enough no votes, in addition to the Democratic minority in the state legislature, to uphold Governor Jay Nixon's veto of right to work. Of course, there are still crazies in the legislature who intend to bring this back next year. Although I recently saw a story quoting the state Senate lead saying, unless the state House leader can marshal his forces and guarantee an override, I'm not going to even bother with this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and this was a real victory. And, you know, we're cranking up here again for the same fight next year. There were some interesting developments in other states, but we really don't have time to go into it. In California, where there were some really pro-worker bills that were passed. In Illinois, where they stopped government.
Let me mention just one. Equal pay for equal work. The federal legislation is 60 years old. It's very weak. California's legislature passed, and Jerry Brown signed a bill to really put teeth into equal pay for equal work. The type of thing that should be done on the national level is now going to be done in the biggest state in the country.
Okay, one last question.
Yeah.
You mentioned a looming threat from the Supreme Court in January. Yeah. What's that?
On January 11th, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case involving dissident California teachers backed by the so-called National Right to Work Committee versus the California Teachers Association and the state. They're basically trying to turn every single state and local government into a right-to-work system.
Yeah.
In so many words.
Right.
And that's what we're going to argue about.
Yeah, and we'll be covering it here, and I'm sure you'll be covering it as well. Well,
mm-hmm.
I want to thank you, Mark, for all the great work you've done in providing us with news and providing labor members all over the country with really important news that just doesn't get covered adequately in the mainstream press. You do a wonderful job, and I hope you continue to do it in the new year.
Okay, thank you very much. Happy New Year, Judy. Happy New Year, everybody.
Thanks.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for December 31st, 2015. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, Tuesday, January 5th at 6:30 p.m. All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum of 2016 will be held on the second Friday with Jeanette Moat Oxford, Executive Director, Friday, January 8th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Westport Flea Market, Buffalo Room, 816 Westport Road, KCMO. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum at www.heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show.
And you can find our upcoming schedule as well as our archived shows at that website, too. So tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be called Junior Rat Race, the Problem of Overtesting. And we're going to have a special feature on an organizing drive in Minnesota, I think it is. It's called Hippie Scabs Are Still Scabs. Thanks to tonight's guest engineer, Maria Vasquez Boyd, who did a great job. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.
Hello, folks. This is Mayor Sly James, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Keep listening. Enjoy.